Let's welcome our political commentators now. It's Neil Jones and Tim Hurdle. Good morning, gentlemen.
Kia ora.
Good morning.
Neil Jones was Chief of Staff to the Labour leader Jacinda Ardern and before that Chief of Staff to Andrew Little. He's the Director of Public Affairs firm Capital. Tim Hurdle's a former National Senior Advisor, was the party's Campaign Director in 2020, is the Director of several companies, including Museum Street Strategies, a public affairs firm. Foreign affairs, it's impossible to avoid it at the moment. The Foreign Minister's speech, making some fairly strong comments about what is happening in Gaza and the humanitarian catastrophe that is Gaza, also meeting the US Secretary of State, and we're reading between the lines on the government's positioning vis-a-vis AUKUS. And then over the weekend we've got this deeply worrying situation that will either resolve following the drone attacks that have been foiled on Israel from Iran, or has the potential to escalate. Who wants to begin? Do you want to kick off, Tim, with what is happening with respect to the new government and its positioning on foreign affairs and our relationships?
Well, I think Winston Peters, with the experience that he's had in that portfolio, is playing a very dominant voice in the dialogue within the government. That's quite clear. He has worked on these issues for many years. I think also there's an awareness that over time there has been a movement away from the what was called the independent foreign policy, and our relationship with China became very dominant, towards the new reality, which is some of the very violent acts that are going on in the Middle East, but also the competition between the democratic powers and what I call the totalitarian powers. So it's a very dynamic situation, and I guess the government is grappling with the issues of the day and trying to work out how do you position New Zealand to be an effective player on the global stage.
Is there a key shifting of position, however, and how significant is what is being said about a possible Pillar 2 involvement in AUKUS, Tim?
Yeah, I think to understand what Pillar 2 is, because I think people often talk about it but don't necessarily know what we're talking about, and even the written material on it is quite hard to find. Pillar 1 is talking about the Australians essentially getting nuclear submarines. Pillar 2 is completely different again, but it's about the technologies and advanced technologies around things like hypersonics, cyber warfare, but also the related advanced technologies that are used in space that drive the modern battlefield, but also, I guess, the modern economy. So it's a question of whether you want to be involved in the technologies as our world is becoming more digital. It's no longer about a guy with a gun. It's increasingly about some stuff that happens in a sort of what looks like a computer game. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about AUKUS. We're talking about New Zealand being involved in that technological development.
With what implications, however? The independent foreign policy has always been a fine line, and of late it has been about the relationship with the United States and maintaining a very strong trading relationship with China. I think they're our largest trading partner. Things move around. But with what implications, Tim, if that alignment is seen to becoming stronger, and to your point, if not militarily stronger, in the form of physical architecture, stronger in the areas where future conflicts may well dominate, and whether it's intelligence or other kind of technologies?
Yeah, this is the big challenge, is how do you define yourself when you have a strong relationship with China, which is increasingly in opposition and a great power competition with the United States, maintain our traditional relationships and connections with democracy, and that fine line of independence is something that's really hard to define in a world where you have to take sides on issues and probably stick up for values that New Zealand believes in, and that can come at a cost. Australia found out that when it pushed back against the Chinese, they had their red wine banned by the Chinese. There's a lot going on in this world. I think sometimes in New Zealand we sit here and hope that no one notices what we're doing.
Well, that's one thing you can't do anymore with the technologies involved in some
No.
ways. The idea of tyranny of
Cyber
distance.
warfare means that,
Exactly.
yeah, cyber warfare means we're on the front line now.
Yeah, the tyranny of distance used to work in reverse. Helen Clark and some others critical of some of the shifts that they see this government taking, as we said, sort of under the radar, if you like.
Certainly signalling some
signalling
changes.
And wanting a discussion about it. What is Labor's position on this, Neil?
Well, Labor's position is to have an independent foreign policy, which has been the bipartisan consensus for the last 40 years. So I think that the independent foreign policy is often misunderstood. There's this view that it means that we kind of say, well, we just sit in the middle and don't do anything. Actually, we are part of Five Eyes. We cooperate with our traditional allies around the world on a case-by-case basis as it suits our interests and our values. But we also maintain good relationships with China, which, you know, is 27% of our exports, almost $20 billion a year. It is a policy that has served us well, and I think, you know, there's been some on the right who have attacked Labour over, you know, saying, well, why aren't you getting behind this? I think it's actually on the current government to explain why it's looking to break what's been a 40-year bipartisan consensus. I understand the current government hasn't consulted Labour on its recent moves. There hasn't been an attempt to be bipartisan. And I do think if we're going to shift away, and again, look, this is all signalling, but if we're going to shift away from what has been the consensus, I do think we need a broader public debate, because this is actually a potentially dangerous time around the world, but for New Zealand. And I mean, when you look at China and how much of our trade is tied up there, they see, I think with some evidence, AUKUS as an anti-China alliance. That's what it is. Now, I realise there's Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, but the reality is you can't just say, well, we're part of Pillar 2, we've got nothing else to do with it. This is a US alliance to contain China. And were China to retaliate at some point in the future on 27% of our exports, I think it'd be quite catastrophic.
Yeah, but Labour wasn't unaware of this. When Nanaia Mahuta was foreign minister, she was the one making speeches to business and industry saying, you need to be less reliant on China, you need to diversify your export markets.
Yes, and that is an ongoing challenge, and that is consistent with independent foreign policy, not to become an economic vassal of China, which is something we risk doing. Can I just say, though, I do think as well... When it comes to AUKUS, there is a risk. You know, it's not inconceivable in the next 10 to 20 years that there is conflict in the Taiwan Strait and the South China Sea, and New Zealand could end up being part of that, and it could turn nuclear.
But could we ever not be part of it?
Well, potentially.
Realistically.
What,
do you think we'd just be left alone in the middle here? We wouldn't be a staging post.
Yeah, we don't have to go to war with China. We don't have to go to war with anyone.
Nobody wants to go to war with anyone.
But a few years ago, no one thought Russia would invade Ukraine. So we are in a world that is increasingly dangerous. And I would add, the US, they are obviously more aligned with our values than China, but they are an unreliable ally. You look at Ukraine, where the Biden administration wants to support Zelensky, and House Republicans are blocking arms. Imagine in November, Trump wins the White House, and you know what would New Zealanders think about being part of a military alliance with Trump in the White House? I just think this is an issue that's serious for New Zealand, and I don't think we're having the level of public debate that's merited.
It is challenging, Tim, because that independence has also been buttressed to some extent by 75, coming up 80 years of peace that certainly resembled nothing like the 20th century or some centuries before it. And I suppose what is on people's minds now is what is happening in Europe and the Europe that we knew pre the Iron Curtain falling, let alone conflicts in two world wars, appears like it is under challenge. What is happening in the Middle East, recurring, obviously, but reaching another very risky flashpoint at the moment. What is happening with respect to China's ambitions vis-a-vis Taiwan, and then what the United States would ever do were there ever to be a situation. Have the circumstances shifted enough to justify a move in a policy that could only be seen to have served New Zealand very well?
Yeah, well, I think the shift was actually signalled by Andrew Little last year in his defence policy statement, which had bipartisan support, which basically deliberately said that we don't live in a benign strategic environment anymore. That shifted really in my mind, quite significantly where we had our policy settings. But just picking up your point on Europe, I think people need to really contemplate the fact that Helen Clark's always been very strident in her view that we need to have this independent foreign policy, and has cited examples like Sweden as countries that somehow stay neutral. Well, Sweden has signed up to NATO. Finland has joined NATO. These countries who sat through the whole Cold War, Sweden, a country that had been neutral for two centuries, is seeing the need for collective responses to security. And this is what we, as New Zealanders, we can't win a war on our own, but we do have to stick up for the things that we believe in.
And this is in fairness, at least one of those countries directly borders Russia,
There is a slight difference there, because Sweden and Finland borders Russia, and Sweden is very close. Mm. And again, I go to the point that China is 27% of our exports. It is a growing power. It will likely eclipse the US militarily in the coming decades. And I think the independent foreign policy has served us well when it's benign. But in an era where the world is dangerous, I think it also serves us well, because it is not an option for us to be aligned to China, because it is a dystopian authoritarian regime that's increasingly aggressive. And I also think going fully in hoc to the US place New Zealand's interests at threat, both because of our trading relationship with China, but also because I think the US is an unreliable ally because its domestic politics is so broken. And so that's why I think an independent foreign policy is more important than ever. And it doesn't mean sitting on the sidelines doing nothing. It means charting a course, if we have, as we have for the last 40 years, in New Zealand's interests.
What is the status of a bipartisan position on this, Tim? A bipartisan position on anything is often difficult to achieve, but it is one area where historically there have been greater efforts made. It's very interesting to see a former National Party leader very much supporting Helen Clark's position and saying stay out of any deeper alignment that would take away that independence. You know, what are the possibilities of this being a bipartisan debate or slash decision? Is there one?
Yeah, I think there were some comments last week by former Ambassador Tim Grosser, who's been around foreign policy for 50 years, but, you know, he was a national minister, but I do listen to him and realise he had a strong diplomatic career. And his view is that the Labour Party will drift off into the more extreme left elements when they're out of government, because this is, to my mind, some of the Helen Clark comments are quite a shift on from where Andrew Little had got to last year. And I see that the Labour Party MPs are hosting a function at Parliament this week to discuss this topic. So I think, they should be debating these things, but it shows that the ability of Labour to actually come up with a coherent position where alignment is bipartisan will actually be quite difficult.
I mean, I go back to the fact the independent foreign policy has been the orthodoxy for both parties for 40 years now. Andrew Little, as Defence Minister, was open to looking at it, but Labour did not decide to join AUKUS.
The question is how it's applied, Neil, in practice, right? So,
yes,
if New Zealand takes on any kind of relationship with AUKUS, does that threaten the independent foreign policy or not?
I mean, look, these things are open to debate, but I think were we to sign up to Pillar 2 of AUKUS, depending on how that looks, that could put us firmly into the US camp, and that's certainly the view of the Chinese ambassador who wrote in Newsroom over the weekend.
Okay, let's...
If we're independent, we don't do what the Chinese tell us.
Look, of course, as you know, we do what we want, but I think if you were to join a US alliance to contain China, that is by its nature not having an independent foreign policy.
All right, let's have a look at some of the other matters that are about at the moment. We note that the Prime Minister here responded, as one might expect, pretty much in lockstep with many other leaders in calling for a de-escalation for what is happening in the Middle East, and we are all watching and will continue reporting on what happens over the next few days, whether this is the end of the matter with respect to direct engagement between Israel and Iran, or whether there are further steps. Let's come back and look at home. Week feels like a long time ago, but Luxon, the CEO, Prime Minister, as he perceives himself and as others certainly perceive him, has come out with his 9 targets for the next few, what is it, the next 100 days or beyond?
This is 10 years.
10 years.
Oh, sorry, 6 years. 6 years. 2030.
What do you make of it? Are they, again, targets? Governments have them, other governments give up on them or say they don't help, they don't work, and then another government brings it in again. Is there anything surprising or particularly ambitious in these?
I think targets are generally quite useful. They give a clear direction to the public service and to ministers and also to the broader public about what you're trying to achieve, and there's something you can be held to account on as well. I don't think there's much politics in attacking targets for the sake of it. I do think there is a risk with targets sometimes that there are perverse incentives. One of them I'm particularly concerned about is point five, which is 50,000 fewer people on the job seeker support benefit, which, you know, that's quite a blunt number, particularly if unemployment goes up. But regardless, the risk is that that you end up with policy settings that are aimed at just driving people off the benefit as opposed to getting people who can work into work. And so I just think there is a risk there that you end up with that kind of perverse incentive.
Neil, does it fit with, Tim, does it fit with the PM's own persona, his own image of, you know, I'm the guy who chunks things down and breaks things down and fixes things?
Yeah, and I think that's why he's doing it. There's also a contrast with the perceived failings of the last government, which was a failure to deliver. So by setting out some ambitious targets and some ideas about where the general direction is, you focus the public service around what you'd like them to focus on. There are always boundary issues, as Neil points out, but I think without any direction, things just drift sideways. So I think it's probably a good way to get his things lined up.
I also do think the CEO thing works for Luxon. You know, he's that background, I think, was enough to get him national from about 25% to about 40%. People often see someone with a background in business as a kind of sign someone is good with money and can get things done. And given the general narrative around the previous government and delivery, I think him showing that he is leading like a CEO, putting out clear targets, that's the best thing he's got going for them. You know, he's never going to win, I don't think, on sort of personality and likability and charisma, but I think if he can do that kind of CEO thing, I think enough people, you know, that might work for enough people.
The problem is when you put things out to be measured, Tim, and they are measured, is that a reason to make sure some of them are next term or the term after that, potentially, before you get your homework marked?
Yeah, and I think that's part of the problem is there's a difference between probably what Christopher Luxon, the Air New Zealand CEO, would have set out as targets and KPIs to measure his employees against versus what political reality is, which is you don't really want to set up anything that you'll able to see a very easy fail on. I think we always saw the example of the KiwiBuild targets under the last government as being seriously an undoing about the credibility of the government to deliver.
National lost a vote in Parliament this week, which has quite the history to it. Could you talk us through it, please, Tim?
So there was a vote which essentially... There was a quirk of a court case back in the 80s where a certain citizenship rights for Samoans, what was known as Western Samoa in those days, was expunged by legislation as a consequence of the court case. It's bubbled around as a quiet issue. It affected about 100,000 people, I believe, but there's not a lot of those people even left alive, I believe. But what happened was then... that issue was brought forward as a private member's bill to try and deal with the issue, to give those people back their citizenship, and it's gone through to select committee despite National voting against it.
Why was there a split vote?
I think that's probably a very interesting question to put to the National political managers.
A matter of political management,
Yeah, I would have thought it was something to do with probably taking officials' advice about, because this issue's bubbled around for 40 years and never been changed, and they probably thought we'd just do the orthodoxy, but it didn't pick up on the political consequence of which is there was a lot of people in the gallery watching it who were in favour of it, and I think probably the coalition parties saw that this was going to be a hard thing to say no to.
Mm. Look, I don't think the fact the government voted different ways on a members' bill is the end of the world. That's kind of par for the course. It's no surprise to me that New Zealand First voted for it. I mean, one of the things Winston Peters has been very big on is building relationships in the Pacific, and that sort of goes to our previous discussion. But I do think National probably should have voted for at least a select committee. You can, you know, they got a bit of flack for both the split vote, but also for their position on it, which looked a bit mean. And I think it doesn't hurt just to say, look, it's worth having a listen to it, select committee, and then make a decision.
Let's just touch on, well, the question is also, why the hell has it taken this long?
I think one of the things is the stakes probably aren't as high now because there's very few people alive comparatively who would be affected by it. Also, you know, politics doesn't just, things don't just change in the world. They change because someone puts forward an argument and there's a bit of momentum. And there was a Green Members Bill that went up and that put it on the agenda. It may well be that it just hasn't been put on the agenda before.
Let's just touch briefly on the Greens for now. James Shaw's departure coming closer, of course, with his Members Bill that he was staying to usher, well, going nowhere, I think, in the end, was the outcome. So we await finding out when he might actually depart the Parliament, and we'll do a bit more of a reflection on his contribution nearer that time. But, Tim, you've noticed there's been quite a few portfolio changes. In fairness, the Greens have had a hell of a run, right, and have had to change some positions as a result of things that have happened. But do you see the changes you're looking at as sweeping wider than the necessary?
I just think that they have had a... but you've got to bear in mind that they've lost, is it 4 MPs since the election through various circumstances? And, of course, that means that nearly a third of their caucus has changed out. There has been somewhat of a change around in some of the way that they're presenting these things, but they're going to have a lot of probably... new spokespeople in quite important portfolios like, well, foreign affairs and some of the crime and justice areas. So it'll be very interesting to see whether those new spokespeople take the Greens in a different direction to where they have, especially when you consider it that they're probably the most moderate voice in James Shaw's gone. So it does probably lead to interesting questions about where the Greens are headed in the next few years.
As I'm reading, a big load going on the new co-leader, Chloe Swarbrick, with finance and climate change. They are two large and absorbing policies, especially picking up climate from James Shaw, who played such a role in the construction of the previous legislation. But, you know, to your point, just reflects a time of considerable change in the lineup of that party.
Yeah, and look, it's a time of change for the Greens, and there is some risk with James Shaw going on, and there are some who have said, well, they might risk losing some moderate voters. That's been signalled, but their polling's gone up in the latest poll. I do think that Chloe Swarbrick, as well as being very able herself, I think the Greens have a pretty solid base of support now. The days of the Greens sort of falling below 5, I think, are probably over for now. Because
except one wonders how much of that support that has grown is a contest with Labour, which is still sitting very, very historically low.
That's always the case, that when Labour does poorly, the Greens do well. But, you know, we live in a world where inequality and climate change are increasingly big issues. I think there are a lot of people in the public, well, a significant minority who want change on those things, want
tax.
It urgently, tax, and don't have time for the sort of game of slow reform Labour has to do. So I do think they've got a pretty solid base there, and I think they've got an opportunity to grow it if they play the cards right.
All right, thank you both. That is Neil Jones and Tim Hurdle.